Thank you for listening to Torah Media Atlanta. Won't you consider making a donation to help support this important work? Just go to TorahMediaAtlanta.com and click on the donate link. Thank you very much.
Okay, we're on chapter 14, verse 25. We're talking about the downfall of Babel, of Babylonia. And they were the ones that had destroyed the Beit HaMikdash. And they were unusually arrogant. And that's one of the things that Hashem doesn't tolerate, is arrogance. In fact, arrogance is considered a form of idol worship, because it's really self-worship. You think you're a god. You think you're something special. You're not acknowledging that it comes from Hashem. And it's a person that has that quality, that's arrogance, is just like an opposite of what Hashem wants from a person. Regardless of how a person could keep kosher and keep Shabbat and study Torah, but if he has the arrogance about himself, then Hashem doesn't want to be near him. That's like the opposite quality of what in the schools of Musar they talked about. It's not just a question. Of course, we have to do the mitzvahs. That's what Hashem commands us to do. But He wants us to be good people, and He wants us to be like Him. And one of the attributes that Hashem's attributes is humility. And the one who He gave the Torah through was Moshe Rabbeinu, who was the most humble of all people. Throughout time, that sometimes certain individuals forget that lesson, the idea of humility or the importance of humility. And all of our great people who we consider great had that trait, that they were very humble. Now, being humble doesn't mean that they weren't aware that they were capable people or that they had to accomplish things, but they didn't think anything was coming to them, for they didn't feel that they were special. They could talk to anyone. When you meet people like that, you know it right away. You're just, you know, here's a person who's so important, and when he talks to you, he makes you feel like you're important, right? That's one of the characteristics of a humble person. But Babel had a certain arrogance about them. They were given their moment of glory on the stage of history, and very quickly it was taken away, and they were overrun by other kingdoms. Now, as soon as Babel was no longer on the scene, so there were other nations that were there, and they thought, okay, now that Babel's gone, Babel was our enemy as well, now we can rejoice and we can be happy and we've got nothing to worry about. Well, unfortunately, there were a number of bad peoples in the Middle East. In other words, it wasn't just in one area. And we very much, even today, we were talking a little bit about this last week. There are different names for the nations in the Middle East. But there's more than one nation that's a source of trouble. If it's not Hamas, it's Hezbollah. If it's not Hezbollah, it's Syria. If it's not Syria, it's Iran, right? And so these are all the same players. They live in the same place, and they're probably descended from some of the same peoples. But it's not just one of them that's misbehaved, that hasn't acted appropriately, and that at some point they'll give an accounting. I'm not a prophet, not a son of a prophet, as they say. But certainly, you know, Syria, which has a history of being really wicked and nasty towards the Jewish people, it's as much as we hate to see the harming of innocents, but it's hard, on the other hand, not to see some retribution in the fact that country was the most vehement against Israel and against the Jewish people. I'm sure in every war there are innocents, and you're not happy about innocent people and about bloodshed, but these things happen, and it's part of the divine plan, and you have to believe that there are those that are being punished for their wickedness towards the Jewish people. And Syria, it definitely, if you study the history of it, has always just had a hatred for Israel that is just not explained. You know, there was no territorial issues with Syria. You know, Jordan, Egypt, they had territorial things. Syria really didn't. They just hated Jews. So it's interesting. In our times, you know, we see every day you read the news. There's fighting going on. They're fighting between each other. And for us, it's really miraculous because who's fighting? Al Qaeda in Syria is fighting against Hezbollah in Syria. Those are both groups are people that have shed so much Jewish blood. And what are they doing? They're fighting each other now. And so it's I hope they both win. Like that. So without being callous, their children and there are other people who maybe have not become so wicked yet. But there's an idea that sooner or later there is an accounting. The accounting, if it came to Syria, if that nation at their time comes for their punishment for what they've done to Israel and over the years, their attitude towards Israel and the terrorism. Nobody ever talked about this, but all the terrorists, their base was in Syria all the years. That's where they were. That's where
supporting them.
With money. Mm-hmm. He was supporting them and other things, and so. It's just, normally I try not to get too much off topic, but you'll see that's very much the topic over here, is that the nations of the world, everybody's given their chance, but ultimately their behavior is punished if they deserve it, and retribution does come. So here, the main power of Babylonia was taken out of the picture, and next there's Assyria. So Assyria shouldn't think that they were going to get away scot-free. And this is what it says, verse 25. Now, Babylonia was much in the future. This Assyria hadn't yet, Lishbor Asher Ba'artzi. What Hashem's plan was interesting, that Assyria came into the land of Israel. Now, when they came into Israel after having conquered many countries, and so they had all their booty with them, and there was a siege going on in Jerusalem, so there was no food in Jerusalem. So what happened was that in Israel, the people were starving and had almost no food, and this huge encampment was waiting outside with packed refrigerators of food and gold and silver. And so when that army was destroyed in the middle of the night, there was enough food to feed the whole city. And the people at the time, there were prophecies that had said that the price of food will go down, there'll be plenty to eat. And if you remember, the scoffers at that time said, what, you're going to open a store in the heavens? Where's it going to come from? And it came from these armies that were encamped outside. It was just that they had planned on conquering other countries, and they had their war chests there, and they had lots of food and lots of supplies. And in one night, they were destroyed. And so Hashem's plan was to bring them into the land of Israel and then break them there, so that they would bring all of the food and all of the wealth from these other countries they had conquered to our doorstep. So Lishbor Asher Ba'artzi, Valhar Avusenu, and they were brought to the mountaintops. Vesor Me'aleim Olu, and the yoke of this country would be removed from us. Vesivlu Me'al Shikmo Yasser, we wouldn't have to worry about them anymore. They were the neighborhood bully, and now they were gone. In 26, Vizosa Eitzaha Yutza. Very interesting. Whenever they double words in Hebrew, it comes out very poetic. This is the plan that was planned. The Eitza means like a plan, or what was foreseen. The fact that they would come into our land and be destroyed right there, and that would actually be the thing that would help rejuvenate the land, that would give us a new supply of gold and silver and all the wealth of the armies that had come. By the way, we had a similar experience with Egypt. When Egypt attacked us at the sea, the chariots were packed with gold and silver, and they all had jeweled swords and armor. That was part of the Egyptian. And in fact, after the Egyptians were drowned, Moshe Rabbeinu had a hard time getting the Jews to move away from the sea, because they were picking up all of the booty that kept floating to shore, valuable jewel. Egypt was the major country of that time, and so the Jewish people who had just got out of slavery were picking up diamonds and rubies and emeralds and jewels and gold and silver, and they weren't really in a rush to leave. Well, we got to go get the Torah, guys, come on. The people were just, having worked so hard, they were picking up the, but that was also part of Hashem's plan, that sometimes Hashem brings us wealth in unusual ways that we could not have predicted or thought about. And so this plan that Usher would come to our land and be destroyed and leave all of the booty there, that was part of the plan. And this was Hashem's outstretched arm against these nations. 27. Ki Hashem svakos yaot. This was all part of Hashem's advice. And our army was very small at that time. If you remember, Chizkiyahu was the king, and he had a very small army. The Jewish people, their strength was in their studying. If you remember, he was the one who put the sword in front of the study hall. To this day, it's very interesting that even Jews that are secular are very into studying, like it's part of their mother's milk. The Jews are motivated to get higher education, and scientists are trying to have, social scientists have studied this to try to figure it out, but it really goes back to hundreds and hundreds of years of parents understanding the importance of study, of Torah education, of coming, on a rainy day before a holiday, coming in to study. What would make us do that? Nobody likes to go out in the rain. The answer is it's in our genes. When it's done for so many centuries and years, where our parents are about the importance of, so some people they no longer have Torah to study, so they study other things, and it's an overall search for wisdom, because we believe that wisdom is Hashem put lots of wisdom in the world for different things. The power of Chizkiyahu was not in his army, but it was in the studying that they did. So the army that's on our side when we study is the Hashem's army. And so over here, when it describes Hashem, it uses that word. We try not to say Hashem's name, so I pronounce it Tzvakos. But that it means that they always translate it as the Lord of Hosts. But unless you've never really pictured what that means, you have no idea what that means. There are people who have been davening for 20 years. What does it mean, the Lord of Hosts, right? But the idea of Tzva, a Tzva in Hebrew is an army. So we say that in the prayer for Israel, for the army, the Tzva. So what it means is that it might appear that we have a small army, but actually we have a very large army, because Hashem has millions and billions and trillions of forces at his disposal. And so whenever we describe Hashem as being almighty and of the multitudes, we use that word Tzvakos, meaning that Hashem has all the powers at his disposal. So it might seem like our army is small, but Hashem's army, Hashem's Tzvakos, Hashem's army of the Chabad once started a youth group. They called it Sivios Hashem, the army of Hashem. That was that idea. Same, that word Tzva, that's that same word of the army or the multitudes. He thought he had a bigger army than us. He didn't know about our secret weapon. We have a much bigger army.
Interesting, that's a feminine word.
Yes, yeah, it's interesting.
Is it related to mitzvah?
Tzva? I'm not sure. Some of the question is really part of what's going on in Israel with the question of drafting yeshiva students. In other words, if we're going to defeat our enemies, are we better off having people that study Torah, or are we better off having them marching back and forth and practicing with the rifles? And now, obviously, we need to, Hashem doesn't want us to rely on miracles. We always have to be pragmatic and practical. And so as long as the country is able to have students that wish to study are able to, and there's enough people for the army, that's the ideal world. What the right formula is to determine how many study and how many go to the army, I can't say I know what that is. Actually, as we speak, that's one of the issues in this election right now going on in Israel, because the old draft law was declared illegal by the Israeli Supreme Court. And so even though they've been fighting over this issue for the last 40 years and they keep on refighting it again and again, well, they have to do it again. And so the current election in Israel, the big issue is how many yeshiva students do we draft? How many do we not draft? Is it appropriate? Was it not appropriate? What should we do? But to what extent, Now, when you ask people that don't really believe in religion to have religious studies going on and not being drafted, that's an interesting thing to ask of them. Most societies believe that the real strength of that society is in their wisdom and in their search of, you know, certain college students are exempt and certain doctors are exempt, and so certainly certain rabbis should be exempt. In fact, yeah, the United States, even during World War II, gave exemptions to the war for people that were studying full-time in rabbinical colleges and seminaries. In fact, a lot of the first yeshivas started during the World War, and some people felt that they would close afterwards because the only reason people were going to that was because they didn't want to go to war. And they surprised people, and then even after the war, they many of them stayed open. It could be Vietnam helped that a little bit, too. This is the moving along. So, B'shnas Mos HaMelech Achaz, in the year of the death of Achaz, Ha'ilama says that he had the next vision. Now we get to, we're talking about a reckoning with the other nations. Now comes the Palestinians. There was still a group of the Plishtim, the Philistines, and they were very happy now that the nation of Asher was not there. They thought now they could do whatever they wanted. So he continues on with his prophecy. Altis Mechu Plashis. The Philistines, they shouldn't, it's not time for them to be happy. Kinishbar Shevet Makecha, because the stick that had hit you until now is going to be destroyed. Do not think that now is your time. Ki Mishoish Nachas Yotze Sefa, because from the source of the snake will come further snakes. Now, most people actually say that this, basically, when sometimes a person feels he's defeated a snake, there's like a small snake that comes out, or the snakes, it's very hard to defeat the snake. Here he's actually referring to Chizkiyahu, to the Jewish people. In other words, once the kingdom of Asher was defeated, so the Palestinians thought now was their turn to subject the Jewish people. And so what he's saying is that the Jewish people will even though they were weak, they would be a new king who would come out, who would be a young whippersnapper, and he would be able to overcome you. And it describes them as something coming out of a snake. I don't know why. We think of a snake as a very negative kind of thing. But over here, it's most of the Mephoshim learn this refers to Chizkiyahu. Perhaps they were afraid of a snake. So that was the word that was used in the prophecy. It's an interesting thing. In this week's Parsha, when it talks about the tribe of Dan, it compares them to a snake. You know, he'll attack like a snake. It's not every snake is a bad snake, or it's not always used as a bad metaphor. Even though the original snake certainly is a bad thing, but there are certain things we learn from a snake. Sometimes a snake was used in that they blended into the environment, and you don't see them until it's too late. You ever see a snake slither? If it's not slithering, you wouldn't see it. Because it's the exact same color as the, so that's a describing a, something that you're not aware that could harm you. It's describing that the police team think that now they're going to take advantage of the Jewish people. You should know that it's going to maybe they lie hidden like the snake, ready to go. Here's Seraph Mofes. And it describes them as a flying snake. I don't even know what that is. If there's a flying snake, there must have been some kind of flying. Maybe they fell down from the trees. I don't know any naturalists over here who know the. Hopefully that's what they were saying, is when they heard about these flying snakes, this was their chance really to do teshuva and to change that.
Chagall's in some Chagall's paintings, he has flying snakes.
Yeah. Oh, really? That's interesting.
Well, they're leaping from tree to tree. They're not, they're not actually flying. It's like, you know, the monkeys going from tree to tree. Those are the snakes that you see in most of the Chagall paintings. Yeah. So, there is that sort of feeling that they're going from tree to tree. You know, it's sort of like flying.
Yeah. Let's see. Yeah, in Hebrew, the word mofesh doesn't necessarily mean flying with wings. It just means, that could be used for many. Airborne, that's right.
Well, they can do, I mean, you know.
How do they do that? I mean, if you're, on a tree and they have to slither on the ground.
Yeah, not necessarily. I mean, you can take a vine or anything, the way people go from tree to tree and just, you know. Yeah.
It's not too realistic.
Well, I mean, look what they're doing now in all the jungles where they've got these, you know, tree things and yeah. You get in a harness and you fly from tree to tree and everything, you know. It's not beyond imagination.
Mm-hmm. Right. I imagine they must have had something that existed in their time that seemed to them like a flying serpent. Maybe it was some other creature that could also be like a type of serpent or a...
We're not near dragons or anything like that.
No. We didn't have quite that imagination.
Yeah, it must be something more realistic.
We have the plague of frogs. Some people felt that it was alligators. Just to give you an idea that we really don't have... There's a big difference between a frog and an alligator, right? But we don't... Sometimes when the ancients used words describing creatures, we don't really know exactly what they were referring to. So even though we commonly translate this as a snake, it could be some other flying, you know, serpent or creature. 30. Ru b'chorei dalim. The Jewish people were described as poor. People took advantage of them. They were interested in studying and interested in tending their sheep. And you had these warrior nations throughout the Middle East that wanted to spoil them. And so the firstborn of these poor people, Vevyonim, Levetek Yibitzu, they're not going to have to worry about you coming and attacking them. And we just talked about the irony of it that in history, they used to talk about Palestinian terrorists 1,000 years ago, and today's Palestinians are no way connected to the Plishtim. They're not the same people. It's because they called the land Palestine. They adopted that they were Arabs that were living in the area that was called. In fact, before the Arabs used it, Jews used to call themselves Palestinians. In other words, in the 20s and 30s, when Jews lived in Israel, they would say, "I'm a Palestinian. I'm living in Palestine."
When you went to Palestine. Even in the Yishuv, they went to Palestine.
Mm-hmm. It was once we adopted the name Israel, or that's when it changed. But so they stuck with it. In those times, the Palestinians would make terrorist raids. Most of the time, it was to steal things. It was to take the crops, and so Hashem here is saying that these. The firstborn children, meaning that they will have families and they'll be secure, will be secure with their sheep. And these Palestinians at their root, they will die. And they'll be eliminated. He then tells the Palestinians, things are going to be so bad that you're going to be crying out. And this word... he translates it as howl. I think that's because it's similar to the Hebrew halil, howl. But I'm not sure. Howl we usually associate with a dog. This is more of a cry out rather than a howl. I guess, does a dog howl when it's hurt or even when it's not hurt? Not necessarily that it howls. It's a sign that that something's bothering it when it's howling. Okay, but this, I think it's halilu, it lets them cry out for the gates. Zaku od namug pleshes. They would want to go to their cities where they'd be more secure.
One of the words in here, instead of howl, is lament, which is really a cry.
Yes, that's a little bit better, lament, but I think they liked howl just because it sounds similar to the Hebrew halilu, but lament is probably the more accurate.
It says wail.
Oh, yours says whale? Okay. Yeah, whale's probably more accurate. Yeah, the whale. But mine said howl. But I guess sometimes they wanted it to be similar, to have a similar ring. Mm-hmm. So if they had a translation word that was similar to halu, howl, they thought, oh, great. Sometimes you'll see that in the Rosh Hashanah Maxer also, they would try to use a word that was similar to the Hebrew and different styles. So Zaku Ir Nava Plishis, the city of the Plishtim will melt away. Ki Nitzafon Oshinbo, and there'll be a fire like smoke. Vein Bodim Amodav, and there'll be nobody will feel comfortable there. Nobody will be there. Uma Yana Malache Goy. What are the people going to say? What? How are they going to explain their situation? They're going to say Ki Hashem Yosad Zion. They're going to say that Hashem is. Sticking up for Zion, that Hashem is calling the shots. It's interesting, after the Six-Day War, there were people that said that, that God is fighting on the side of the Jews. That was, it was clear to them. They didn't make excuses, and for a short amount of time, it didn't last very long. And then they blamed they said the U.S. was sending planes, and they made up stories as to. But the real reason is because Hashem Yisarti, and Hashem is enabling the Jewish people to be strong. And his poor people, his impoverished people, he's going to take care of, and that's the end of that particular prophecy. But now he continues on again with the different nations that had taken advantage of the Jewish people, who were just wanted to tend their sheep and study Torah, and were overwhelmed by these different warrior nations who basically took turns whenever they had the chance to conquer these other nations. One of the nations in that area was Moab. Those were the nations that were descended from Lot. And technically they were related to us. They were our cousins. They were descended from Abraham. And they never acted like cousins. That was part of the problem. In other words, Moab, now they get their prophecy of doom. Yeshaya is interesting that he talks about the nations of the world. In other words, some of the prophets only talked to the Jewish people. He had messages for these nations. And I assume that he read it out to them. I assume or they got the message somehow. I don't know if he traveled or... we find that with Yonah, that he traveled to Nineveh, and the nations respected the Jewish prophets. They would travel to meet them. When people see holiness, they recognize it.
Okay, Masa means prophecy. I see you.
Usually, the Hebrew word Masa means a burden, something that you carry. And so he wanted them to carry this burden, to know what their future would be for what they had done, for their behavior. I'm not sure how often that's used as a prophecy, this word Masa.
It was used in one or two chapters back.
Wasn't it similar to that?
It opened the same way.
I see. Uh-huh. The sense of a burden would be that they carry a burden, or they carry a load.
A load.
That's the word that they're going to have to deal with. When the people have done evil and wrong, then they're going to have to face the consequences of their action, and so they're going to carry the load. In other words, this is what they should know what to expect, what their actions have led them to. Chapter 15. So Masa Moab. So this was the story of Moab. Ki Belel Shudad or Moab Nidma. This was the they'd be attacked at night, which was unusual at that time, and they had surprise attacks. They were overwhelmed by this was what happened is Sancheriv, on his way to destroy Israel, also destroyed Moab. And so it's interesting, the Sancheriv was the king of Asher or Assyria, and he was the one that died outside the gates and left us all the booty and the plunder, and most of that booty and plunder came from Moab. But the people didn't understand how Hashem could have allowed, if Hashem wanted to punish him, why didn't he punish him where he was? But in effect, what happened was he came, destroyed all of our bad neighbors, and then he brought all their booty and deposited it right outside. So it turned out that actually having Asher come to our land did us a big favor, because he destroyed the bad neighbors that we had, and he also brought us all the booty. And so the people were questioning, why did Hashem do this to us? Why was he allowing the Gentiles to come in our land? Especially we were loyal and we were learning Torah and we had a righteous king. And how could it be? And there's an idea that we have lots of questions. And sometimes over time we understand, or we come to an understanding of why things happen the way they do. And so the one of the reasons that Sancheriv came where he did was he wiped out our neighbors for centuries. We had these neighbors in the Middle East who were causing problems, and one of them was Moab. And he would come on Moab at night, tear Moab Nidma, and he was going to wipe it out. Ola Habayis, when the Sancheriv came, the Moabites went up to the pray to their gods. They were steeped in idolatry, so they went to, Ol HaBayis means they went to their temple, so to speak. The Divon, and they have the archaeology. They found these idols. You can they can show you what Divon looks like, and you know you can see the Moabite idols. But these were the altars that were destroyed. Val Nevelam, and part of what Hashem wanted to happen was they would see that their idols were powerless. They always assumed they had the strongest gods, they had the best gods, and then when the enemy came, their idols did nothing. And so they went up to their gods and they davened and they cried out to them, Moav Yelilu, the Kol Rosh of Karcha. And every head was balded, Kol Zakin Gerua, and every beard was shaven. It's describing the Moabites. If their hair being balded and shaven, even today sometimes I think in sports you say they got to shave, like, you know, like they were just decimated. They were just taken off.
But it says it was as if they were sleeping silently. So they weren't really sleeping. They were just as if they were sleeping. They were so weak. Or
mm-hmm.
something.
Right, that's right.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it was hard to explain. It's almost like we had cases like that in World War II. You know, France had the best army in Poland, and they were overrun. Like, they just were sleeping.
And
it just,
they were sleeping.
Yeah, it just didn't.
Maybe Hashem decided to stay that time.
Mm-hmm. That's right. That's right. So they just were like sleeping. The Chutzas Chavrusa, outside, the people would wear sackcloth, Agag Oseha, and they would cry out on their rooftops and in the streets, Yolo, Yor Debechi, you would hear crying and mourning. Four, Vetitza Cheshbon. Cheshbon was another one of their cities. He's describing them in detail. If you just hear a message, you will be destroyed. It doesn't, but if you actually describe and you say, well, this is going to happen in Damascus, and this is going to happen in Aleppo, and this is going to happen in this river, and these were places, landmarks that they were familiar with, it was very real. And so this prophecy describes the cities that would face the, where they would hear the crying and the wailing, and in Cheshbon, Yatz Nishma Kolam Alkein Chalutze Moav Yeriu Nafsho. And the armed people who were afraid of nothing, the armed terrorists, they would cry out. I mean, imagine waiting to hear the armed terrorists, you know, cry out and humble themselves a little. Nafsho Yirlo, their souls will cry out. Now, an interesting thing happens over here, and this is the Jewish soul. Moav was one of our enemies. They deserved everything they got. They were not a good people. But when he's describing the suffering they would undergo, he starts crying himself, Yeshayahu. Because, you know, the Jew was soft. Libi Lamoav. He said, you know, my heart goes out to you. I feel bad for you guys. That's only the Jew is like that. The Jew is the only nation that's a soft heart. Even to their enemies, they help their enemies. It's always been that way. The you know, the Israel, they always treated, you know, I think the head of Hamas, I think his brother was sick and he was treated in an Israeli army hospital. You know, there was an article about that a while back. But my heart goes out to Moav, Yizah, Barichaha Ad Sohar Eglash Shulishaha. He says to the city of Tsohar, and they were like a third born. The third cow was always the strongest. And so the Moav had this was a very strong, proud nation. Kimale Haluchas. Luchas was the name of another one of these cities. In those areas, you'd see Bechi crying, Yalabo. Kidera Choronim Zachas. Choronim, these are either cities or rivers and areas that they had. Through these paths, that everywhere you'd go, you would see destruction and mourning and crying, Shevayar. Kimei Nimrim, the Nimrim River. I don't even know if that's there anymore. Shemeth you. Ki Yavish Chatzir, and the grass would dry out. Yerek Lohaya, all the beautiful vegetation, the land would be scorched. Why did this happen? Verse 7, Al Kain Yisera Asa. Because of all the stuff that they did. Al Kain Yisra Asa. Because of their actions. And eventually, Hashem remembers what they do. Actions don't go unpunished. And they're going to be taken out. The people will be sold into slavery. They'll be. When Sancheriv came, he transferred nations. He took them out of their lands. And the cry will come all over Moab, at Eglam, Yasu, Be'er, Elim, Yulasa, to these different places. Ki mi demon molidam, and their river of demon will be full of blood. ki asher sardim and asafes al plate smolas. And this, in the, this big river that they were very proud of, that would be where the remnant of Moab would go out through that river. They counted on that. That was a lion. That was their pride. But now they would go out as a remnant. And this was all that was left of the strong nation of Moab. And again, it was their punishment for the their deeds. And that's been the more or less the theme of the last two chapters. Very interesting message for Xmas. You know, when the you know, to us, the it sounds very harmless, you know, the but we've known the results of this religion that we live amongst, that it's always led to bloodshed. It doesn't lead to high morals or the good people. It all sounds very nice, you know, silent night and, you know, the turn the other cheek, but it's never happened. They don't turn the other cheek. It hasn't produced it doesn't produce love and understanding and belief in Hashem. And even though there is some value to Judaica-Christian ideas, and not every, and there's certainly a lot of sincere people out there, but as a religion, it has a history, and it's produced. Warfare and bloodshed and wickedness and immoral behavior and. So, you know, unfortunately, when people want to value religion, so they look at Islam and they look at Christianity and they say, oh, they're all bad. They don't realize that you can have a religion that brings people to godliness and closeness to Hashem and all goodness and nothing negative. But they look at, and that's why today we live in a time when there's so many people that don't believe in anything, because the so-called religions have given a bad name.
Thank you for listening to Torah Media Atlanta. Won't you consider making a donation to help support this important work? Just go to TorahMediaAtlanta.com and click on the donate link. Thank you very much.